Now we're going to look at one more illustration, and this is Fred. Jim was a low bottom drunk. Jim had lost everything he had through drinking. Fred is a high bottom drunk. Fred's never lost anything through drinking. And Fred does not believe he's as bad as the other people were. And yet he ended up getting drunk, just exactly like Jim did. He believes something that is not true. Let's look at Fred's insanity.
Now then, we want to look at the comparing these two. Now, they're all the same illustrations, talking about the state of the mind just before we drink. You know, Jim was down in the dumps when he got drunk. Fred's going to be up on top of the world when he gets drunk. So, you know, it's the same thing that happens.
Seems as though when we feel bad, we drink to feel better.
Yeah.
When we feel good, we drink to feel better yet.
That's right.
Fred felt great the day he got drunk.
Fred is a partner in the Weldon and County firm. His income is good. He has a fine home. He's happily married, a father of promising children of college age. He's so attractive a personality, he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was success in a businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he is alcoholic. We sort of first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves.
We see lots of nerve resters in AA today, just like old Fred.
Yeah. Dr. emulated strongly that it might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself to be an alcoholic.
He would not take step one.
Much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem.
If you can't take one, you can't take two.
We told him what we knew about alcoholism.
They told him about steps one and two.
He was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms. He said, I'm a little bit alcoholic, you know.
Borderline case.
Okay. But he was a long way from admitting he could not do nothing about it himself. He was positive that the humiliating experience plus the knowledge he acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. We heard no more Fred for a while, and one day we were told he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us, and the story he told is most instructive. For here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking. He had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. He said, I was much impressed with what you fellas said about alcoholism, and I frankly not believe it was possible for me to drink again. He said, I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. In other words, this would never happen to him again. He said, I reason I was not so far advanced as most of you fellas. I ain't bad as y'all. And I had been usually successful in licking other person's problems that would therefore be successful where you men fail. I felt I had every right to be self-confident. It was only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on going. Now, he said, in this frame of mind, I went about my business, and all for a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks, and I began to wonder if I had been making too hard a work out of a simple matter. Now, Jeff, Fred was getting drunk right here. So he said, this is getting sober. Man, this is easy. This ain't nothing. Anybody can do this. He got it made. And then, this member, Jim, was in the dumps. Let's see how Fred did it. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before doing this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. He said, physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased, and you, my partners, would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon.
Boy, he's just he's just floating along, isn't he?
He is, guys.
God, everything is great.
Man, he's feeling good. Now, let's see what he did. He said, I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. Now, here's a squiggly writing. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind, it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails and go back to the hospital. I mean, what a great day. I believe I'll go back to the hospital.
Yeah, that's the truth. There's no way he could drink on the truth. So he had to believe something that's true. He said it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. Now, based on the insane idea, he makes a decision and takes some action. I ordered a cocktail in my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. Now we got inside ourselves. The allergy takes over, and now we can't stop. After dinner, I decide to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I'd commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. You know, Jim vaguely sensed he wasn't any too smart. Fred didn't even sense that. Fred just thought a couple of cocktails with dinner would be great. Now, is his real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, or that he has a form of insanity? An illusion, a delusion, an obsession that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol. The real problem centers in the mind rather than in the body. Page 43, last paragraph. Once more. We said all of this now to say it one more time. Once more. The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from the higher power. Now, Bill has closed the door on me now. You know, he recognized that I wasn't going to like the solution in step two. He recognized that I would probably say, well, fellowship's okay, but I don't know about this spiritual experience stuff. And I'm not sure I want to do that. So I think he said to himself, I need to tell them some more about alcoholism so they can see what's going to happen to them if they don't have that spiritual experience. And in this chapter, he's shown me exactly that because of my insanity, if I don't have that spiritual experience, sooner or later I will begin to believe that I can drink. And I'll become insane thinking I can drink. And the next thing you know, I'm drunk and I'm sick and I'm all kind of... He's closed the door on me now. And I also noticed in that last paragraph, he didn't say the drinking alcoholic or the practicing alcoholic. He just said the alcoholic. Now that means to me today that left on my own resources, I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. The period of time I've been sober is really beside the point. You know, it wasn't too long ago in the city of Tulsa, about a month ago, a lady went to an AA meeting and she sat down at a meeting and she turned to the guy next to her about halfway through the meeting and she said, I don't believe I'm an alcoholic. And she got up and she left the meeting. She went to a restaurant, ordered dinner and a bottle of wine. She drank the wine, didn't eat the dinner, and she'd been drunk ever since. And she only had 21 years of sobriety when she did it. You see, she forgot that she had no effective mental defense against the first drink. And she got away from her program. She lost her contact with God. She began to draw away from her fellowship. And next thing you know, she became insane. So it can happen to any of us, unless we are very aware of the fact that it can happen to us as well as anybody else. Now, if you are the kind of alcoholic that I am, and if you'd been raised in the church setting that I was raised in, and you've been able to see exactly what your problem is, what your solution is, and you've been able to see through chapter 3 that because of your insanity, you're going to drink again if you don't find this God that you probably don't understand anyhow, then you would be faced with one terrible dilemma. Because I knew at the end of chapter 3 exactly what would happen to me if I didn't find God, but I also knew that it would be impossible for me to find God, because I knew that God would have nothing to do with me because of what I had been in the past. You know, that good old Southern Baptist church I was raised in, I love it today, it's a good church. But when I was raised in that church, I'm sure they talked about a kind and a loving God. But if they did, the message never got to the pew that I sat in as a kid growing up. Because all I ever heard about God was hellfire and brimstone. You go to hell for lying and cheating and stealing and drinking whiskey and committing adultery. By the time I got to AA, I'd been doing that for 26 years. And I knew that God had already told St. Peter, when that little four-eyed sucker gets up here sitting him downstairs, we'll not need his kind. I remember very clearly the day that I separated from God and from the church. As that kid growing up, they told me in church what I could do and what I couldn't do. They said, if you do this, this, and this, you're going to be okay. If you do that, that, and that, you're going to hell just sure as anything. And I had no trouble with those rules until I got to be about 12 or 13 years old. And one day it seemed as though the minister looked me directly in the eye and he said, to think about doing it is just as bad as doing it. And I said, oh, crap. Because I'd been thinking about doing it for quite a while. In fact, I'd been thinking about doing it long enough, I was starting to get a little brain damage from it. And I decided if you're going to go to hell for thinking about doing it, then you might as well just do it. And I did. And I didn't go to hell immediately. And I remember distinctly saying to myself, that sucker has been lying to me all along. And I made up my mind that day. I said, that preacher and my parents and those teachers have formed together in a conspiracy to keep me from having any fun, period. And from this day on, I do not intend to pay any attention to what they have to say. And from that day on, I became a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. I said, to hell with God, to hell with the preacher, to hell with the teachers, to hell with my parents. If it's going to happen, I'm going to have to make it happen. Now that was at 13 years old. No wonder when I got here at age 38 that I had trouble with this God thing. How many of you got here the same way I did? God, nearly all of us, somewhere back down the line, the same things happened to us. And Bill did that. You see, remember, Bill's a real alcoholic. And he knew that the next thing he's going to ask me to do in this book is to make a decision about that God thing. So he's already shown me one. He's already shown me two. Now I'm going to have to decide, am I going to go after that spiritual life or not? And he knew, based on old ideas, that it would be absolutely impossible for me to make that decision. Because after all, who's going to make a decision to turn their will and their life over to hellfire and brimstone? Nobody's going to do that. And he said, I'm going to have to give those people like Charlie some additional information so they'll be able to make their decision. And he wrote another chapter And he called it We Agnostics. I think it's one of the greatest pieces of spiritual information I've ever read in my life. There's a priest out in California named Father Bill. And at age 15, he was recognized as being an exceptionally brilliant young student. And they sent him to Rome, and he was to stay there until he was 35 years old. And through that period of time, Father Bill has received three doctorates. Now, one doctorate's a hell of an accomplishment. He got three of them. He's a member of AA today. And Father Bill says, the chapter to the agnostic in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest piece of spiritual information he had ever read in his life. Now, that's quite a deal coming from him, because you know he's read thousands and thousands of books on this stuff. And he said, the reason I think it's so great, he said, it's because that chapter does not try to prove to anybody that there is a God. He said, what that chapter does is give people some new ideas that will open up their mind, and then God can prove to them that there is a God. And I found out that's exactly what happened to me in this book. My mind had snapped shut against these spiritual ideas. And based on old ideas, it would have remained snapped shut. But in this chapter, I was able to see some new ideas that let me discard some old ideas that opened my mind up just enough that God has proven to me that there is a God. And I think it can happen to every one of us if we'll approach this chapter with the idea in mind that we're going to look for new ideas so we can discard old ideas. Let's see if we can't see these new ideas in this chapter.
In the We Agnostics, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism, and we have. We hope we have made clear a distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. He says, if you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit it entirely.
That's because of the obsession.
Because of the obsession. Or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take.
That's because of the allergy.
You are probably alcoholic. I love the way he says that. You're probably alcoholic. I'll give you two questions. You know, it's real simple, you know, to determine if you're an alcoholic. We can take this little test, answer these two questions. You know, we always laugh about it now. We know how we humans improve on things. And they used to have two questions to find out if you was alcoholic. Now we got 44 questions out. You don't need but two. You don't need but two. And it's plainly to determine if you're an alcoholic.
Now, I'm glad that Ebby didn't have the 44 questions when he walked into Bill's kitchen that day. Bill sitting there drunk, hungover, felt like hell. Ebby would have said, Bill, has alcohol been bothering your reputation? Then he would have said, Bill, has alcohol been bothering your sex life? Hell, if he's anything like I was, he hadn't had any of that in years. He would have confused the hell out of Bill. No, we just knew two questions. I use them all the time today. People come to me today, they say, Charlie, you think I might be an alcoholic? I say, I don't know. Let me ask you a couple questions. Have you been able to quit drinking entirely on your own resources? If they're real alcoholic, they got to say no. And then I say, do you have any control over the amount you take once you start drinking? If they're real alcoholic, they got to say no. And then I say, well, you're probably an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And it's just that simple. You know, we tend to complicate these things to the point that nobody can understand them. The simplicity of these two questions always amazed me. You know, we had an old friend lived in Tyler, Texas, named Wino Joe. Wino's dead now. But Wino made up a list of questions to ask yourself if you're alcoholic. First one on his list was, has the roof of your mouth ever been sunburned? He said, if it has, you're probably an alcoholic. Now, Now back to paragraph one, last sentence. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. You know, we are very unique people. We number amongst a few people in the world who have an actual illness of both the body and the mind that can only be overcome by a spiritual experience. We also number amongst a few people in the world who have a terminal illness, that we can come out of it in better shape than we went into it if we can have that spiritual experience. Now Bill says, to one who feels he's an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death,
step one,
or to live on a spiritual basis,
step two,
are not always easy alternatives to face. And that's exactly where I was.
That's right.
I thought that such an experience would be impossible. Now, you know, an atheist is one who says there is no God. And therefore the atheist has no power greater than human power to turn to. And therefore the atheist would think that a spiritual experience would be an impossibility. And I said, Charlie, are you an atheist? And I said, no. Mm-mm. I've always believed in some kind of God. And I said, well, then you must be an agnostic. So I had to go to the dictionary again and look that word up. And the word agnostic is made up of two old Greek words, ag and gnostic. Ag means without. Gnostic means knowledge. So an agnostic is one without knowledge of God. And I said, you reckon you're an agnostic? I said, you bet your boots I am. I've always believed there was some kind of God, but I had no knowledge of a kind and a loving God. My belief that I had always was hellfire and brimstone. Therefore, I never turned to God for help. Stood on my own two feet, run my own show. And I got the same results from that the atheist got, which is nothing. Even though I believed in God, I had no knowledge of God because I had never tried before. So an agnostic would say to himself, since I have no knowledge of God, this would seem to be an impossible thing also. And all of us that come here are one of the two. The only other way you can believe in God is to be a true believer. A true believer is one who says, yes, there is a God, and has knowledge of that, because they've tried to use God's power and God's will. They didn't stand on their own two feet. They didn't run their own show. They turned to God. God responded, and they got the power, and they know there's a God. Now, there's only one of three ways you can believe: to be atheist, to be agnostic, or to be a true believer. None of us come here as true believers. Because if we came here as true believers, we would already have the power and we wouldn't need AA. So we got to be either atheist or agnostic when we get here. And most of us are agnostics. Oh yeah, most of us believe there is a God. But since we've never turned to God for direction and help, we don't know that. We just believe that. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. And our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. Now think what Bill is saying now. It makes no difference what you believe at the present time. You'll still be able to have this spiritual experience. Whether you're atheist or agnostic is beside the point. Now then he says, if a mere code of morals For a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. You know, there's a difference between alcoholics and drunken bums. Drunken bums are about where they want to be, and they're not too interested in changing the situation. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that did not have a set of morals and a philosophy of life. And we all desperately tried to live up to that, just like Bill did in his story. But because of our alcoholism, we couldn't live up to those morals, we couldn't live up to those philosophies, and we found ourselves there with a drunken bum, but the difference is we didn't want to be there. Now, if those morals that you and I have, if those philosophies of life that you and I have, if they had been sufficient to overcome alcoholism, we would have recovered a long time ago. We wouldn't have had to come to AA. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. Oh, we could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, and that's what the atheist or agnostic are operating on, human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. And I know that's true. Because if our human resources, marshaled by the will, could have saved us, we wouldn't be members of AA today. I've never seen anybody in AA yet that said, I took a drink at age 14, jumped up and down, shouted with joy, and I said, I could hardly wait to be a member of AA when I'm 28. This is the court of last resort. We've already tried everything else. And if any other powers had saved us, we wouldn't be in AA today. So we finally boil it down to one thing, and here's our real problem. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Now, it doesn't say which will help you solve it, or which will enable you to solve it. It says which will solve your problem. So those of us who are powerless, and that's every one of us, if we are to recover, atheist or agnostic makes no difference, we are going to have to find a power greater than we are, and that power will solve the problem. Now, I find it interestingly enough on page 45, from there on in the big book, we're through talking about alcohol. From this page on, we talk about one thing and one thing only. If you are powerless, how do you find the power? And if you can find the power, then the power will solve the problem. So let's begin to look at how do we find that power. Let's go over to page 46, last paragraph.
Much to our belief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception of high and attic was sufficient to make the approach. We're talking about the approach and to effect a contact with him. We're trying to contact this power.
Now, I didn't know that you could do this.
Yeah.
I thought that you had to believe as they said you had to believe. They told me in my church exactly how I had to believe. And they said, if you don't believe that way, you're going to go to hell. I didn't know you could have your own conception of God. I thought you'd go to hell for doing that. So right here is the first old idea cast aside and replaced with a new idea. The old idea was I couldn't have my own conception. I had to believe as they told me I had to believe. The new idea is we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. I didn't know you could have your own ideas of this area. So one old idea has been cast aside now, and a new one takes its place. Okay. Now, since I've got my own conception of God, and as Joe says, I've never had any trouble with my own conception of anything. Now then, I've got a God with my own conception that I can start trying to find. So here's where we start.
Okay. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction. Provided we take other simple steps. Now we gotta have to. We just can't make this decision, but we gotta take other simple steps to carry this out. Now
we're opening the door here now for the atheist.
Right.
As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, I've never seen an atheist yet that did not believe there was some kind of power that put this thing together. I've never seen an atheist yet that would not admit that evolution is a form of power greater than human power. The atheist problem is not with God. It's with other people's conception of God. So now that we can believe in the creative intelligence or spirit of the universe, we have now opened the door, not only for the agnostic, but also for the atheist. Old ideas cast aside and replaced with a new idea.
We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive, forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men.
Another old idea cast aside. You know, I thought that to be able to find God, it would be a very difficult thing. And there's only one way you can do it, and the road was very narrow, and the eye was very small, and everything had to be perfect in order to find God. That's what I was told. But here he says, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek him. It is open, we believe, to all men. So I was taught in church that if you don't believe a certain way, forget it. Because you're never going to find God if you don't believe that way. This thing says it's open to all men, whatever their belief is. So I've already, within one paragraph, I've discarded three old ideas, and I've replaced them with new ideas. The mind is now beginning to open up. Page 47.
When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudices you might have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourselves, what do they mean to you? At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth. To effect our first conscious relationship with God as we understood him. Afterwards, we found ourselves accepting many things which seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth. But if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was.
And this opens the door for everybody.
If you're going to grow, you've got to start somewhere.
We needed to ask ourselves
one short
question.
Yeah.
Do I now believe? The agnostic has always believed.
He can say yes.
Or am I even willing to believe?
The
atheist can become willing to believe
that
there's a power greater than myself. As soon as a man can say that he does believe,
Agnostic.
Or is willing to believe.
Atheist.
We emphatically assure him that he's on his way.
Okay.
Has it been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built? That was great news for us. For we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe.
A little tricky here.
Now right here he separates the words belief and faith. You know, one of my problems always with this God thing was the minister always said, son, all you got to do is have faith and you'll be all right. Now, faith implies knowledge. Faith implies surety. Faith is after the fact information. Now, since I had never tried to use God's power in my life, how could I possibly know that I could? It's impossible for me to have faith in the beginning. The best thing I can do in the beginning is to believe. Belief is upfront information. Belief can be nothing more than suspicion. Agnostic has always believed. He's ready to start. The atheist can become willing to believe and he's ready to start. We don't have to have faith. Old idea cast aside and replaced with a new idea. Let me give you an example of belief and faith. Let's say that I moved into this neighborhood here and 3 or 4 months later I have trouble with my car. Now I don't know a good mechanic anywhere in this area. So I might come to you and I might say, tell me, I've got a problem with my car. Can you recommend a good mechanic? And you'll probably say, why, yeah, sure. Take it over there to John. John will do you a good job and charge you a reasonable price. I don't know whether that's true or not. The best I can possibly do with that information is if I believe you strong enough, I'll take my car to John on belief. Now, John does a good job and charges me a reasonable price. And when I leave there with knowledge, with surety. Now, 2 months from now, I have trouble with my car again. I don't ask you or anybody else where to take it. I take it right back to John. This time, I took it on faith. The first time, I took it on belief. You can't have faith to start with. Old idea cast aside, replaced with a new idea. And there's not anybody in this room that does not believe or that can't become willing to believe that there's a power greater than we are. And that opens the door, and we're on the way. Now he said, if you'll notice he used the asterisk again, it's been repeatedly proven among us upon a simple cornerstone. A wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built, asterisk, bottom of the page. Please, please, he's begging us now. Please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experience. This is the third reference to it. And this time he's tied it together with a wonderfully effective spiritual structure. See, that's what we're building. That's what the spiritual experience is. That's what the personality change is. It's a wonderfully effective spiritual structure through which we'll pass to freedom eventually. Now, he's already told us step one. Willingness is the foundation of that structure. Now he tells us believing or being willing to believe is the cornerstone of that structure. So we're already putting the stones in place. We're building the structure. The personality change is now beginning to take place. Anytime I change my belief, I'm changing my personality. I'm changing my attitude and outlook on life. So the personality change already starts, really, right here, just by being able to believe or be willing to believe. And I'm on the road to recovery. Now, if I know I've got to have this power, and I know I can have my own conception of that power, and if I know the beginning of the finding of that power is simply to believe, then the next thing I need to know is how am I going to go about finding that power? And I think on page 551 is one of the greatest demonstrations that I know of in being able to find that power.
Okay, now, like all great textbooks, he's going to give us a demonstration in this little paragraph of how humans use this power of believing. You know, it's ours. All of us own that power. All of us have that ability. And our lives and the actions we take and everything that we do in our lives comes from the use of that believing, that thing, that power that we all possess, and how we apply it in our lives. He said, this world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than in all the millenniums which went before. And this is true. We have made, in the material world, we have made more progress in the last few hundred years. Everything that we use today, we have invented. All the sources of transportation, energy. In the last 100 years, we have developed all these things.
Computers and microwaves and space rockets.
Everything.
Hair dryers and almost everything we use has been invented within the last 100 years.
Almost everyone knows the reason, and we really don't. He goes on to talk about students of ancient history tell us the intellect of the men of those days was best of the day. I didn't know that. I had assumed, you know how we assume, that we have made more progress in the last 100 years because we were smarter than the people before us. But that's not true, they tell me. They had the same intellectual ability that we had. The same natural resources was here, but they didn't make use of it. And he tells us why. He said, the spirit of modern scientific inquiry and research and invention was almost unknown. They didn't invent anything. They didn't discover these things, although they had the intellectual ability to do it. He tells why. In the realm of material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. You know, in those cultures before us, people had great minds. People believed they could do things. This is human. People believed they could accomplish something better. But people couldn't use that because the society they lived in did not allow you to believe different. It made you believe, everybody believe the same. If you had a new idea, you had to keep it to yourself. And if, you know, if you believed the same, you will remain the same. The principle is the only way you can change, you got to believe different. Because if you believe the same, you're going to remain the same. And the society did not allow people to believe different. You know, they would have called you a witch or something, or cut your head off. I can just see a guy back 500 or 600 years ago in Europe and going down the street there in England or London or somewhere with a big box on his head and a hole cut out in the middle of it and some wires hanging out. And somebody said, what is that you making? What is that thing you got? He said, well, I'm going to make a TV. And they said, well, what's a TV? Well, we're going to be able to get pictures from the other side of the world and sound. Well, they'd cut his head off at night, you know, coming up with something like that. But right today, you know, in the society we live in today, we actually encourage people to believe different because that's the only way we can change and make progress.
I hear people even today still saying the same old stuff. You know, they say, somebody says, well, could we do this? Well, no, you can't do that. Well, why? Hell, because it's always been this other way. Okay. Or you're doing something like this and you say, well, how come you're doing that? Well, because this is the way we've always done it and you can't do it any other way.
Yeah.
We are that today. Okay. Superstition, tradition, and fixed ideas keep people from changing their belief.
Right.
And if you can't change your belief, then you can't change anything. The first thing that always you have to do to change anything is to believe you can do so.
Right.
Now, it wasn't but a couple hundred years ago right here in our country, right up in this part of the United States. Hell, they were burning people at the stake because they dared to believe differently. And they called them witches. Now, if they're going to hang you from a tree or burn you at a stake for believing different, then you're not going to believe different. And if you do, you're going to keep your mouth shut about it. Therefore, they developed none of these new things. Well, I remember back in the 1950s, early 50s, people started talking about a spaceship. And everybody said, man, that's crazy. They talked about in the early 50s someday visiting the moon. They said, man, you'll never be able to do that. And it wasn't but just a year or two, and the Russians shot Sputnik up there. See, they believed they could do it. And therefore, they did it. So belief is the beginning of everything. He said, some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth was preposterous. About 500 years ago, most of the civilized world was situated around the Mediterranean Sea and the western shores of Europe, what they thought was the civilized world. And they had found a place that they called the East Indies. And in the East Indies you could get gold, silk, and spices. Oh, goody goodies. And they were trying to find a new trade route to the East Indies because it took a long time to go there. The only way they had to go was to sail to the northeast end of the Mediterranean, then go by land, foot back, camel back, horse back, however they travel. And it took literally years to make that trip. Well, naturally, people wanted the goody-goodies faster. And they said, there's got to be a better way to do this. And somebody said, well, is there any possibility that you could sail a ship there? And they said, well, no, idiot. Only thing you can do is sail it to the northeast end of the Mediterranean. And they said, well, what if we sailed in the other direction? And they said, well, dummy, don't you know that this world is flat? And if you sail out that way, you're going to sail right off the edge of this sucker. Now, I don't know why they believed that. I assume some people sailed out there, didn't come back, and they assumed they sailed off the edge of it until Columbus came along. And Columbus is a perfect example. And Columbus came along and he said, I believe that the world is round. I do not think it is flat. I do not believe you will sail off the edge of it. And he made one of the most drunk statements the world's ever heard. He said, I believe that we can get east by sailing west. That's a drunk statement. Now, if that isn't drunk thinking, I don't know what is. Many of his mannerisms prove that he was drunk. Because when he left, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. When he got back, he didn't even know where he'd been. But what made him a real alcoholic is a woman financed the whole trip. Now, Columbus followed a little formula that the world has always known.
Yes, I failure.
In order to change anything, the first thing you have to do to change anything is you got to be willing to change. And the only reason he's willing to change is because he was trying to find the new trade route. Circumstances always make us willing. The second thing you got to do is believe you can do so. And Columbus said, I believe we can get east by sailing west. The world's round. It's not flat. You won't sail off the edge of it. But his belief didn't do him any good, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed it. Some days, weeks, months, or years later, Columbus made a decision. He said, by golly, I'm going to go find out whether this thing is round or flat, whether you can get east by sailing west or not. But his decision didn't do him any good either, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that decision. Some days, weeks, months, years later, Columbus began to take action. First thing he did, he went to the King of Portugal to get the money. And the king, being a very astute businessman, said, Columbus, there's no way I'm going to let you have this money. He said, if I do, you'll sail right out there and you'll sail right off the edge of this sucker and I'll get nothing back. That's why he ended up with the Queen of Spain. And he sweet-talked her out of the money on the promise that he would bring back gold, silk, and spices and the goody-goodies. And she let him have the money. And he took the money and he bought 3 ships. And he got crew members for those 3 ships. And they put provisions in those 3 ships. And they began to go east by sailing west. Day after day after day after day, they sailed west. Now, we're not sure, but we would assume that Columbus probably hired a special sailor on that first trip,
yeah,
put him on the bow of the lead ship at night with a lantern, whispered in his ear, and said, "I believe this thing is round, but if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler so we can get thing around." After having sailed straight west for several days, watching for the edge of it at night, sure enough, they found land on the other side. Now, we know that he thought it was the East Indies. It was not. It was the West Indies. But what it proved to him is that the world is round. It's not flat. You won't sail off the edge of it. He got results from the action that he took. And he turned around and he went right back to the Queen of Spain. And she said, "Columbus, where's the gold, silk, and spices you promised you would bring me?" And he said, "Sweetheart, I didn't find any." But he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. If you refinance me, I'll go back, and this time I'll find it." And she refinanced him, and he took the money, and he got some more ships, more crew members, more provisions, and they began to go east by sailing west. Only this time there was a big difference. This time he didn't hire the special sailor and put him on a bow of the lead ship at night, because this time he went back on knowledge. He went back on faith. He went back on surety. The first time he went on belief. The second time he went on faith. Now, this little formula is not anything new. The world's always known it. And millions of people have used it to change the conditions of their lives. Now, I would love to sit here and tell you today that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are brand new, that the world has never seen anything like them before. But if I did, I'd tell you a lie, because they're based on the same identical principles that Columbus and every other human beings ever used to change anything. The first thing you got to do to change is to be willing to do so. Circumstances make you willing. Step one. You know, when we can see what we're doing is no longer going to work, when we could admit complete defeat, as Bill did in his story, then and then only do we become willing to change. Step one brings us willingness. The second thing you have to do is to believe you can do so. And step two, we believe that a power greater than we are can restore us to sanity. But step two is not going to have any effect unless you make a decision about that. And in step three, we make the decision to let that power do that for us. But then our book says that step three, that decision, is going to have little permanent effect unless at once followed by strenuous effort to face and be rid of those things within ourselves which block us. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all action steps. And as we take those action steps, just like Columbus did, then someday we will get results. And the results are given to us in the first part of step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. And those of us that had the spiritual awakening, we don't believe any longer. We know. I don't believe God will restore me to sanity. I know that He will, because He has done so. Now, I've gone from belief to faith by following the same procedure that Columbus used. Now, those of us that know, those of us that believe, those of us that have the faith, we can now go back and help the next newcomer come to believe. And they can decide And then we can take them by the hand and walk with them as they take their action. And then they'll have a spiritual awakening. And then they'll know. And then they can go back and help the next newcomer to believe. There's only one thing you and I can't do for the newcomer in this scheme of life. And that is, we can't make them willing. That's a personal job. And how do you become willing to change if you're an alcoholic? By drinking whiskey. That's the only way. People say, I've been in AA working on the stuff. I said, no, you don't work on step one in AA. Hell, you work on step one out there. You've already got step one when you get here. All we can do is help you see what's wrong with you. But you're already willing when you get here. And then you can believe, and then you can change. See? This is so simple. I thought finding God would be such a complicated process that I'd never be able to do that. Isn't this something? To realize how simple this thing really is. And just a few standard ideas that the world has always known will lead us from belief to faith. Now, if I know I need the power, and if I know that the starting of the finding of the power is just to believe, then if I know the rest of the formula to find that power, then the only other thing I need to know is, where am I going to find that power? And I think we get here just as confused about where God is as we do anything else. I know as a kid growing up, I had a picture of God in my mind. I don't know whether I saw it or I just dreamed it. But to me, God was a tall, elderly gentleman standing on a cloud up in the sky. Long, flowing white robes on, long white hair, golden halo around his head, sun rays shooting out of it, and Joe says, a big stick in his right hand. Now, I don't know whether I saw that or dreamed it, but I think one of the reasons I had that vision of God is because in church, every time the minister talked about God, he always pointed up there. So I knew that God had to be up there somewhere. But then what really confused me is I noticed every time the minister talked to God, he looked down here. He talks about him and points up there. No wonder we get confused as kids growing up about where God is. And I look for God, and I look for God, and I look for God. I never could find him. And I think one of the reasons I never could find him is I didn't know where he was. And I never knew where he was till I came to page 55 in the big book. And it tells me exactly where I'm going to find God.
Yet we have been seeing another kind of flight, our spiritual liberation from this world. People who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We have seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, or worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and the miraculous demonstration of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. And that's a fact. We found the great reality that deep down within us, and the last analogy is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. You know, much a fact as I am, that's a pretty good fact. If I'm here, God's here within me.
You know, today we're absolutely convinced that every human being on earth, that's the instant they're born, and maybe even before, seems to have implanted within themselves, usually lying at a subconscious level, some form of basic knowledge. And that knowledge tells us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. It tells us how we should live and how we shouldn't live. Now, some people might want to refer to that knowledge as just plain old common sense. I guess others might want to call it innate intelligence. Some might want to call it the conscience. And I'm positive others would like to refer to it as the soul. And I don't think it makes a bit of difference what we call it, as long as we realize that it's there. And in my lifetime, it has always been there, as far back as I can remember. I used to be getting ready to do something, and some voice within me would say, "Charlie, I don't believe you ought to be doing this." And I wouldn't pay a bit of attention, and I'd go ahead and do it, and I'd just get in one hell of a mess. And that same little voice would say, "See, I told you not to do it in the first place." Now, if that's true, and if that's God, and God dwells within me, then what that really means to me today is I can have my own personal God. I don't worry about whether He's the God of the Baptist Church anymore or not. I don't worry whether He's the God of the Catholic Church, the Hebrew religion, or anybody else's religion. If He dwells within me, He's my God. And He and I can come together with very simple and understandable terms. Old ideas cast aside and replaced with a new set of ideas. My God, I looked all over the world for God, and I never dreamed that God dwell within me. And so last analysis, that's the only place that I'm going to find Him. Now, we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, old ideas, that's what prejudice is, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. The consciousness of your belief, not somebody else's belief, but your belief. And you can believe any way you want to. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? This is the kind of God I can live with. This is the kind of God that I can accept in my life. But the old hellfire and brimstone, there's no way that I could have gone any further. Thank God for this little chapter, because it has given me some new ideas, and it's opened up my mind just enough that God has proven to me there is a God. I think it's one of the greatest things I've ever read. That's all we've got for this morning. Thank you all for being here, and see you later today. I said, we get back to the States, let's try that and see what happens. Next big book study we did was in Chicago. And we got at the end of the break period just like this one, and I stood up and held my hand up like that, and somebody way back in the back of the room started waving at me. And about halfway up the room, somebody said, "What the hell are we voting on anyhow?" It didn't work very good in Chicago. We spent a lot of time now on the doctor's opinion on the first four chapters. And I hope we've all been able to see how they are really necessary for the new person to be able to see what their problem is and what the solution is and what's going to happen to them if they don't find that solution. And hopefully a solution that they can live with. And as we finished up with chapter 4, we could see that this God idea might not be such a bad idea after all. We were able to discard some old ideas and come up with some new ideas. And we were able to see that the starting of the finding of God may not be too hard, at least not as hard as we thought it was going to be. So we're probably now ready to make our decision. And I don't think it's by accident that the next chapter is going to be entitled How It Works. And we all know that as Bill was writing the book, remember, he wasn't really a great author. He had no training in this field. He would sit back and review at the end of each chapter, I'm sure, to see what he had accomplished and then where he needed to be going. And probably by now he sits back and reviews, well, I've been able to show them what the problem is and what the solution is. And I think he says to himself, now I need to be able to tell them how to find that power. And he begins to try to write on chapter 5. Now, remember that the first 40 people had told Bill, we want you to write the book, but it's going to be our book. And we want to see the chapters as you write them, and we'll add to, delete from, and change around, and do whatever we wanted to. And Bill had quite a bit of difficulty with them through these first four chapters in the doctor's opinion. The main problem being a lot of it with this word God. A lot of the members at that time didn't particularly want any God in here. They wanted to be a book more or less for the atheist. Some others were fairly highly religious in nature, and they wanted more religious terms in. And Bill had a hard time trying to come down between these two factions and use words that would still bring in God yet not offend other people. Also, he had been able to see that from the beginning, people were coming in, and some of them were Protestants and some of them were Catholics, and there began to be a few Jewish people coming in and a sprinkling of Muslims. And it's very, very difficult to write a book that's got God in it without offending somebody. And Bill said he just simply could not get started on this chapter 5. He said he tried and he tried and he tried and he just couldn't start. And he said one night while in bed, leaning against the headboard, pad and pencil behind his, pillow behind his back, pad and pencil in hand, trying to start on chapter 5. And he said finally he just gave up. And he put the pad and pencil down and he prayed and meditated for a while. And I don't know what he said. He probably asked God for some direction and the right thought and etc. And meditated for maybe 15, 20 minutes. And then he said he picked up the pad and pencil, and it felt as if the pencil had a mind of its own as it raced across the pages. And in about 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, he had written How It Works, one of the greatest spiritual things that the world's ever seen. And what we're going to do is we're going to read How It Works from the original manuscript as Bill wrote it that night, before the other members saw it and before there was any changes made in it. And I think by looking at it from the original manuscript, we're going to get a lot better idea on what Bill really had in mind when it comes to chapter 5 and how it works. Joe?
Yeah. You say something.
John's going to find it.
Here it is.
Yeah, reason we'll be talking about, Bill had a lot of problems with, you know, the way the book was written. He would do these chapters, and then he would send them to the New York group and to the Akron group. And they would actually have their meetings on these chapters and what was in them. Now, you know what that was like. You know, can you just imagine, and 40 drunks wrote this book. This is the miracle of it, right? You know, I can't imagine it. 40 people been in my group writing no book. You know. Takes us 2 hours to decide on a Coke machine or a Pepsi machine. You know, that's not a book.
I think they ended up with an RC Cola before.
So this was quite a, you know, this book was not an easy project. It was a very difficult situation for Bill. Ruth Hawk talks about how she typed these chapters in the office over in New Jersey. Bill would come over and quote them to her, and she would type, and he would stand behind her and watch it come off the typewriter as he talked. And she says she typed his manuscript 44 times. It was a very changing, you know, they had to comment on everything, and so Bill had a hard time getting these first four chapters done, and then he was satisfied, and then he thought maybe now it is time to really get down to the main part of the book. And the main part of the book is, how do you find this power? And he had the, also remember, he had the little six-step program of the Oxford group that they had been using this night. He thought about that. He read them over. He felt like those steps need to be expanded. He had no idea how many he was gonna he needed, but they needed some expanding. He said that the program that they were using contained loopholes that alcoholics would jump through. So he started out, and then when he finished writing that night, we'll be talking about that. He counted them and then put the numbers beside them, and he found out they were 12. He didn't set out to write 12. He just was going to expand to six steps and ended up with 12. But Charlie's going to read what he wrote that very night before the other members changed it and had their input into, ended up with what we got today.
And I'll try by changing the tone of my voice or pausing or something to point out the differences. And if you'll go through the book with me, I think we'll see there's quite a few. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly, on our knees, ask him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible. except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic,
the doctor's opinion,
some of it in chapter 2 and 3, a chapter to the agnostic,
chapter 4,
and our personal adventures before and after,
chapters 1, 2, and 3,
and the stories in the back of the book, have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. Remember, Bill's a salesman. He's a good one, too. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step one.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Step two.
C, that God can and will.
Still, step two.
If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point, or else throw it away.
Pretty obvious. He was right to the point.
What could be more clear? Now, I think it's very obvious that Bill did not intend for this to be a set of suggestions. He intended for it to be a set of directions. These are the clear-cut directions.
Yeah.
It's obvious that's what he intended. He said so about three times. And they were a set of directions to the individual alcoholic on how to recover from alcoholism. Because he kept saying, you will need to do this, and you will need to do that, and so on and so forth. Now, when the other members saw that, that's really when the crap hit the fan. You know, they had had difficulties with him through the first four chapters. But now then, it really exploded.
Attacked.
Because the first thing they said to Bill is, Bill, you can't give directions to alcoholics. If you try, they'll cut and run on you every time, and they won't do anything. And he said, where you keep saying, you got to do this, he said, you just will not do that. You're going to have to change that. And Bill said, well, I'm not going to change this. And they said, well, you are going to change this too. And he said, no, I'm not. He said, what you don't realize is these are not my words. These are God's words. They came after prayer and meditation. And they said, we don't care whose words they are. You're going to change it. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. And the fight was on, and the fight was on, and the fight was on. And they almost not only blew the book project, they almost destroyed the little fellowship over this particular part of the book. And Bill finally recognized it would probably be necessary for him to compromise. Otherwise, they never would get it done. And he very reluctantly agreed to do so. And at the suggestion of a non-alcoholic psychiatrist who was around in those days, they made some changes. The psychiatrist said, rather than use the words direction, why don't you use the word suggestion? And he said, if you'll do that, you'll still get your idea across. And you won't alienate so many people, and more people will use your book. And he said, where you keep saying you, he said, don't do that. He said, use the word we. Don't tell them what they have to do. Tell them what we have to do. And he said, you'll still get your point across, and you won't alienate so many people. And he said, well, you keep using the word must. Change that to ought. And if you do, more people will accept your book. Now, we don't know. If they had left it like it was originally, maybe today, instead of 2 million worldwide, we'd have 10 million. Also, if they'd left it like it was originally, maybe today, instead of 2 million worldwide, we'd have 10,000. Who knows? Nobody knows.